Dr. Sally Mahood is our guest speaker. Her name and renown are known to many. Sally's devotion to her medical practice and her teaching of medicine have now spanned a number of years, giving her insights and understanding of the human condition on many levels. Child poverty, words to send shivers up our spines, is of particular concern to her. And we welcome this time together, Sally, to learn more of this devastating reality. Welcome.
Thank you, everyone. As a family doctor, obviously the topic of poverty generally and certainly child poverty is an important one, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk to the fellowship about this. I also am very grateful to Joanne for helping me with the technical aspects of this. So she's going to run my PowerPoint for me while I try to speak to you. So poverty is generally by far the most important risk factor for health. It's more important than the usual things that we think of as predictive of good health, like, you know, your family history, your cholesterol level, your lifestyle choices around exercise and diet. Really, age and income are the major predictors of health in every category. Now, just a proviso here, obviously the COVID pandemic has made things worse by far, but most of the data I'm presenting are pre-COVID. Okay, so the data shows that residents in Regina and Saskatoon's poorest neighborhoods are 16 times more likely to be hospitalized, 13 times more likely to have diabetes, 16 times more likely to attempt suicide, 4 times the infant mortality, 10 times the teen births, 5 times the low birth weight babies, and 50% fewer proper childhood vaccinations than those who live in the more affluent neighborhoods of the same cities. The highest income bracket in Winnipeg lived 20 years longer than the lowest income bracket in Winnipeg. That gives you some idea. And this income disease gradient is true for virtually everything. Your risk of dying of cancer, for example, within 5 years of your diagnosis is 47% higher if you're low income versus high income. We can even say, if you're looking at diabetes, for example, that your risk is 3 times if your income is $15,000 versus $80,000 a year. So this income disease gradient is true all the way, everywhere. But child poverty is a much more pernicious, I think, issue, and it has bigger implications. And it's not just about material deprivation, although that is certainly a big part of it. The adverse physical environment is only part of it. Evidence from many countries, individuals who spend their young formative years in poverty, in addition to poorer health, they're more likely to have learning and behavioral difficulties, to be underachieve at school, to become pregnant early, to have lower skills and aspirations, to be low-paid, unemployed, or welfare-dependent adults. So while it's true many children from poverty don't fall into these categories, poor children are actually at much more risk for all of those things. And we like to believe that a universal public school system is an equalizer. But this is demonstrably not true. By the time poor children reach kindergarten, after years of inadequate nutrition, poorer housing, higher rates of asthma, infectious diseases, and low immunization rates, limited reading at home, little or no preschool experience, they are already at a disadvantage that's difficult to overcome. And we use this term, the 30 million word gap, to indicate the size of the gap in vocabulary alone between high-income children and those who live in poverty. It's been measured in daily exchanges, words heard by the child within the first 4 years of life, and their cumulative language experience and skill development. And this achievement gap starts very early. You can see from this slide that it actually starts in the first year of life, and its effects are subtle but very powerful. Overworked and stressed parents, poor literacy, overuse of screens, lack of time to read, sing, talk, leaves children disadvantaged from preschool on. Up to 15% of school children in Canada have reading delays, and most children who haven't mastered reading by grade 3 will never catch up. Decreased skills, decreased aspirations, and more discouragement follow. So child poverty has this cumulative and enduring negative impact on children's health and development and school readiness and educational success throughout their life's trajectory. Now, I'm just going to ask you to vote with your hands. Obviously, these children are born to fail unless we seriously address child poverty and invest in early intervention. I'm wondering what people would say to what percent of children in Saskatchewan are poor. So how many people think 3%? No? Good. How many people think 10%? Okay, well, 26% is the correct statistic. I'm going to try and talk a little bit about who's poor and why. We have an overall poverty rate in Saskatchewan at last count of 15%. That means there's 140,000 people, equivalent to more than half this city, that live below the poverty line in our province. But in children under 18, the risk is much higher. In 2020, fully one quarter, so one in four kids in Saskatchewan live in poverty. Our rate is 26.2%, and that ranks third highest in Canada. The only competitors being Manitoba and Nunavut. The poorest children in Saskatchewan are in female lone parent families, where our poverty rate is about 48%. 37% of Saskatchewan's Indigenous population live at or below the poverty line, and that actually excludes on-reserve data, so it's probably much higher than what I'm saying. But importantly, 60% of Saskatchewan poor are non-Aboriginal, so we're not just talking about Indigenous people. And we can break this down a little further. Lone parent families obviously are overrepresented, three times more likely to be poor than dual-income families, and female-headed single-parent families are much worse off because of the gender gap in pay. Full-time working women in Canada continue to earn 71 cents for every dollar compared to men, and women of color earn only 38 cents on a dollar compared to men. So these pay inequities are on top of the additional stress of single-handedly juggling work, family caregiving, poor access to daycare, transport, decent housing, and inflexible workplaces for single-parent mothers. And parents of young children are generally younger, and they have less work experience, they have more debt. Other high-risk groups in our province would include immigrants, the disabled, and some geographically concentrated groups such as people in small towns, rural Saskatchewan, the north, and then some inner-city neighborhoods such as our own North Central. Very significantly, and because I think it points the way forward for policy solutions, poverty in Canada used to be concentrated amongst seniors. But seniors' poverty has markedly declined since the mid-1970s, when the CPP and the Old Age Security were brought in and expanded successfully to address the issue. Now, this data are predictably reflected in our statistics about food insecurity and food bank use in Saskatchewan. Hunger Count 2019 showed high food bank use in Saskatchewan, particularly among children and young adults. 45% of food bank users in Saskatchewan, so almost half of them, were children age 17 or younger, significantly higher than in Canada as a whole, and certainly higher than their proportion of the population. Food bank use has steadily risen in both Canada and Saskatchewan over the last decade, and of course, the pandemic will have worsened this trend. In 2017, we saw an increase of over 17% provincially in food bank use. In 1 month, I think they measured 31,000 people in the province used a food bank. So it's quite, it's phenomenal, really. And it's easy to get lost in the statistics, and I don't want to do that. But there are some statistics that really stand out for me. This is one of them. Child poverty in Saskatchewan is about 25%, probably higher. Where does that put us in the world comparatively? Well, the OECD average for child poverty is 12%. Mexico's rate is 22%. And child poverty in Turkey is 25%. So Saskatchewan's right up there with Turkey, has double Mexico's child poverty rate, and at least double that of most of our OECD neighbors. So I say so much for Scott Moe's glistening wheat fields. It's pretty shocking. Many people have comfortable myths, I think, about poverty, that poor people are lazy or don't want to work or addicted to drink or drugs and or want an easy life on welfare. And this allows them, I think, to protect themselves with indifference. And it's harder to blame children in this way. And so I want to challenge that myth with perhaps my most telling statistic, which is the shocking fact that 37% of poor children in Saskatchewan live with a family member who works full-time. So full-time employment in this province doesn't guarantee freedom from poverty or freedom from the need to use food banks. And this reflects our current minimum wage, which is $11.45 an hour, which works out to an annual income about $23,816. There's a bit of an error on that slide. So do you think that's an annual income above or below the poverty line? It's actually below the poverty line. Our minimum wage does not give you an income above the poverty line, even if you work full time. So we have the lowest minimum wage in the country, and 96,000 people in our province earn less than $15 an hour. But you'll hear the Saskatchewan Party arguing that small business can't sustain a raise in minimum wage. But actually, more than half of all minimum wage earners in this province work for large employers, companies that hire more than 100 employees, companies like Walmart. So arguments that raising the minimum wage will cause more small business failures are really, and more unemployment are really spurious, I think. And the stereotype that the average minimum wage employee is a teenager working at McDonald's is also not true. 40% of minimum wage workers are over 35, 60% are women, 37% are immigrants, and shockingly, 33% have post-secondary education. So, and many are caring for children, obviously, who deserve better. And in addition to low wages, many such employees also lack workplace protections, medical and dental benefits. They have no sick leave, no holidays, no maternity leave, and they face the anxiety of insecure employment. So I want to talk for a brief moment about government programs that are meant to address poverty and food insecurity, because here again, our welfare policies have failed our children and their parents and are getting worse. The cost of eating healthy in Saskatchewan report of 2018 says that for a family of four, you need $245 per week on a provincial average to feed that family. So it varies from, you know, north, rural, but keep that figure in mind, $245 a week to feed a family of four. And under the Saskatchewan Income Support Plan, or what we call social welfare, the adult basic benefit is $285 a month. That includes food, clothing, travel, personal and household items. We can move on to shelter benefits. That's for housing. In the average single adult shelter benefit for Saskatoon and Regina is $575 a month in 2019, which should include rent, mortgage payments, taxes, or any other shelter-related costs, and that would allow $711 per month for a family of four. The Saskatchewan government minister, who was Merriman at the time, introduced this new Saskatchewan Income Support Plan to replace the previous assistance plan, arguing that the changes were to, quote-unquote, improve independence and self-sufficiency so clients could choose how to spend their money. And those are direct quote from Merriman. Caseworkers were to be freed up to do motivational interviewing to help people set their goals and work to achieve them. Obviously, advocates like me are concerned that the changes actually make things worse because shelter and personal allowances no longer specifically cover actual costs of utilities. Clients will now need to pay utilities out of a slightly higher shelter allowance. And the last time I looked at average rents in Regina, for example, the average accommodation rent was $1,018 a month, but the shelter allowance is $525 a month. So really, is it any wonder, we can go to the next slide, that we have homeless children, and 10% of Saskatoon's homeless are actually children, which is, again, a shocking fact. So the average person in Saskatchewan spends 22% of their income, that would be you and I, on housing. But low-income people in Saskatchewan actually spend up to 60% of their income on rent and utilities. In fact, that's part of the definition of poverty, is having to spend that kind of percentage on your housing. So the changes that were made just obscure the fact that government assistance rates are no longer adequate to cover the actual costs of shelter and utilities. 43% of food bank users in Saskatchewan use food banks because their social assistance benefits are too low. And estimates are that we've seen a 19% decrease in the real value of social assistance benefits in Saskatchewan when we compare 1990 to 2017. This shows over time how assistance rates have been stuck for a decade and really have not kept up with the cost of living. So it's no wonder that there are a plethora of charities attempting to feed people on welfare or low income. We have breakfast and lunch programs ranging from Carmichael to community associations to friendship centers to churches to Salvation Army, you name it. And the majority of food insecure households in Canada are reliant on employment income, but those who are reliant on social assistance are actually falling further and further behind. And suggesting somehow that the poor would benefit from motivational interviewing to help make positive financial decisions, I think, adds insult to injury. It suggests that poor budgeting, not inadequate funds, cause poverty. The plan will also add to the already enormous caseloads and resource shortages in the Ministry of Social Services. Social assistance recipients are left on the phone lines for long periods of time. I don't know if any of you have had occasion to phone a worker. I have a lot, and it's hours of waiting, sometimes out in the cold, and face big bureaucratic delays in accessing support. But the ministry has earmarked $300,000 to train their staff on motivational interviewing. Some consultant made that money. This reminds me of similar approaches to poverty-induced hunger, whereby we pay someone a good salary to instruct poor people on proper budgeting and cooking, when the research has actually shown that individuals who live in food insecure households have the same cooking abilities, the same menu planning habits as those of us in higher income brackets. So ignorance is not the fundamental problem, whatever stereotypes we would like to believe. It's lack of money that's the problem. Now, before we talk about possible solutions, I want to touch briefly on one other area that impacts children in poverty, and that is our investments in early childhood intervention and education. We do a good job of ensuring kindergarten access for all five-year-olds, but for the population under five, we actually fall far below OECD averages. 44% of children experience difficulty with basic crucial developmental skills at kindergarten entry. And there's strong evidence that access to quality education should begin much earlier than it does, and that that would help income inequality. Saskatchewan and Canada have fallen behind, and their policies have fallen behind towards young children, failing to catch up with the scientific evidence. If you wait for children to fail, you've lost so much capacity by that point that it's really impossible to catch up. Canada's spending on early childhood education relative to its prosperity ranks the lowest among first world countries, and roughly $3 to $4 billion per year below what it would take to meet the OECD average. Saskatchewan is last or second last in the country in per capita child care supply, and we have a high birth rate in certain populations. So we're laggards in per capita investment in young families and children nationally and provincially, and our programs, such as they are highly targeted to small subgroups of children, thus having little impact overall. Our low results for reading, writing, and math reflect this and are much worse for the 15% of children who are Indigenous. We need universal investments and supports for young families and programs in all communities, not just targeted to a few neighborhoods or demographics. And the main emphasis should be on affordable, regulated, high-quality early learning and care for pre-kindergarten children everywhere in the province, but especially in the cities where most people live. It's rational and it's cost-efficient. We know that $6 is saved for every dollar we invest in early childhood interventions. Fiscal restraints in the 1990s derailed national daycare programs, and we're paying the price now. In Canada, Quebec has actually led the way in this regard, not just with universally public-funded daycare, but also in social housing. And analyses of the impact of universal daycare on female labor participation, which results in improved family income, improved child outcomes, particularly for disadvantaged children, is very clear. Women entering the labor force lifts many families out of poverty, and the increased tax base has been shown to more than pay for the program. So there's really not even a financial argument against this. So this is one very clear policy direction in which we need to move. Secondly, I think we need to address the issue of income inequality. It's a gap which has grown much wider in the last 20 years. The only increases in personal wealth in recent decades have been in people who are already wealthy, some obscenely so. Canada's two richest billionaires, for example, own more wealth than the bottom 30% of our population. Two people have as much wealth as 30% of our population. And the top Canadian CEO earns his annual worker's salary by lunchtime on January the 2nd. So he's been working a day and a half. Anyway. And I was just reading about the remuneration packages for local Saskatchewan billionaires like the head of Cameco and Nexium. They're making millions as well. So it's not just the rich in Ontario. It's also in Saskatchewan. Canada is among the countries that have experienced the largest increases in income inequality and also the most significant declines in child well-being. Interestingly, overall indexes of child well-being more closely correlate with income inequality than they do with actual average income. Now, that's an important point. Children's well-being is powerfully shaped by societal structures that are often much more pervasive than just access to books or preschool. And relative socioeconomic positions more important than absolute levels of wealth or poverty. So children do better when they live in more equal communities, and income inequality is bad for children. To be relatively poor is to be living in a world of chronic stress, a stress that takes a toll on parental and child health. There's epigenetic and biological impacts of chronic stress that we're only now being able to recognize. Parental experience of adversity is passed on to children through pathways that include parental mental distress, long working hours, higher levels of insecurity and anxiety and debt and domestic conflict. And there's an analogy been made for children, the impact of children on this kind of chronic stress of inequality being likened to being bullied all the time. So to be a poor child is not as bad if income differences between children are small and everyone's in it together. And it's far worse if other children are wealthy. So our policies have to demonstrate a commitment to equality if we want to nurture healthy, happy children. And prescribing money works. I'm not going to address this Manitoba min income, but I can talk about it if there's time. But just as we eliminated poverty amongst the elderly with programs like the CPP and the OAS, government transfers do reduce child poverty. The Canada Child Tax Benefit, Universal Child Care Benefit, the GST, HST are examples. Raising the Canada Child Tax Benefit amount to just $5,100 per child per year could result in a 37% reduction in child poverty in Saskatchewan just from that one national initiative alone. Nordic countries, I think, have shown us that child poverty can be reduced by universal welfare policies and job creation strategies that support gender equality, and they've shown us a little bit of what is possible. Now, I hope I've already made the case for the importance of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. $15 an hour is a goal that's based on the hourly wage that would be required to keep a full-time employee above the poverty line, not $11.25. $15 is, and that's why you'll hear the slogan of $15 an hour. Another important policy lesson that stems from the understanding of everything that we know about child poverty include, and I'm not going to go through these in great detail, but progressive taxation, very important. We need to get rid of inheritance taxes, property and rents, financial transactions, close the tax loopholes that make it impossible for the obscenely rich to avoid their fair tax obligations. We need to eliminate low pay and precarious labor conditions, and we need to strengthen labor unions. One of the reasons this inequality has happened is because unions have lost a lot of power and membership in the country. We need to enhance food security, unemployment insurance, pension and low-income supplements. We need to regulate employment and social rights and gender equity. We need to set inequality reduction goals and meet them instead of just setting them and ignoring them. We need to socially invest in children with, as I've talked about, early high-quality childcare that will help women seek employment, and then we need to pay women the same wage we pay men. We need to invest socially in housing. I've talked about addressing work conditions. Housing. $1 spent in housing saves $11 in healthcare costs. Unbelievable. It's the first step in reducing healthcare and stabilizing many families, and I can give you umpteen examples from my practice. The studies even demonstrate that children who live in renovated public housing, where mold, crime, and broken elevators no longer dominate, are healthier than those that live in older public housing and have fewer emergency room visits and illnesses. Supportive housing initiatives show the same savings in decreased hospitalizations, and we save vast sums on healthcare dollars by improving people's living conditions. But we have to put the money in upfront first. We have to go upfront and we have to go upstream. The final thing I want to just talk about is addressing social inclusion. And in Saskatchewan, clearly that behooves us to talk about racism. These are some incredible stats. Indigenous people in Saskatchewan are 33 times more likely to be incarcerated. 13% of their children are 13% more likely to be apprehended. They have a 60% higher high school dropout rate. And this last is very distressing. 41% of people in Saskatchewan blame Indigenous people themselves for their problems versus 26% in Canada overall. So we need to address racism and issues of social inclusion if we're going to address this. Now, before I kind of conclude, I want to just briefly talk about the impact of COVID. Quite apart from the trivializing slogan that we're all in this together, we emphatically are not all in it together. COVID has pulled back the curtain, I think, on inequality and low-wage work and all of its implications, both for those who have to do the work and the recipients of their human services, like residents of long-term care. The mental health challenges have escalated, food insecurity has increased, there has been limited access to childcare, job training, appropriate work, social activities, and added anxiety about how to feed your family. And this has had a special impact, I think, on children. The move to virtual learning has left poor and racialized children less likely to be able to access school and forces those with the fewest resources into this unfamiliar online learning environment. And this has a greater impact on those who have limited English, who have special education needs, who live in high density, low income crowding, multi-generational dwellings where transmission is high. Your mother or father cannot be an effective tutor when they don't have access to technology or they're busy wondering where you're going to get your next meal. Toronto's high-income neighborhoods had a much higher percentage of kids returning to class after the first wave compared to low-income neighborhoods. And anecdotally, I think this is going to be shown to be true for Indigenous kids in our own province as well. So we're also seeing an increase in domestic violence and the negative impacts on both physical and mental health, higher morbidity and mortality in communities that are impacted by poverty, no matter what country we look at, actually. So finally, poverty remains the most severe obstacle to children's health and their learning. And if there was ever a historic opportunity to walk back the retrograde effects of flat wages, of cuts to benefits, of limited access to social programs, withdrawing social investments in the future, I think it's now. Instead of investing in high-stakes testing or charter schools for the entitled and a hardening of class lines in the society, we really need to move to address inequality, invest in universal social programs, and create a more equal society. And this approach did pay off for our society after the Second World War, and I think it will again if we invest. Poverty costs us $3.8 billion annually in Saskatchewan. Literacy problems tied to poverty cost $10 billion per year in Canada. Substance abuse tied to poverty is epidemic. Income, not cultural status, determines these disparities. And up to now, we've focused only minimally on mitigating the effects of child poverty rather than removing the root causes. We have a robust body of evidence that confirms the significance of childhood poverty experiences on lifelong health, learning, well-being, and the power of early intervention in altering this course. And the returns on such investments in our children are, I think, our only way forward. And I feel that now is the time.